Sweet in the morning. Oh Lord, it's sweet in the morning. Hello, my name is Bernard White, and this is Wake Up Call. I want to welcome you to this edition of Wake Up Call on Radio Justice. I'm a bit under the weather today, so I've reached back into our archives to share with you the program of February 7th, 2017. I hope you enjoy it. Sweet in the morning, 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 sweet in the morning.
It was a cool autumn's day when they got underway and the conference convened in Berlin. They were the best of the West and they came to assess and contest the positions they were in. And so they laid out a map and they started to rap about who wanted what and agreed to a master plan to divide the land and to satisfy the greed. Angola is yours, Zimbabwe is mine. The Bakongo kingdom will split. We will not flag from our goal to conquer and hold the entire continent. While there's silver and gold and riches untold and diamonds that cover the ground, the trees are so high that blot out the sky and millions of creatures abound. There's monster-like beasts with ivory teeth and leopards and lions and such. There's coconut trees that sway in the breeze and fruit trees that yield to the touch. This river's so wide you can't see the other side. The mountains will be to the moon. The stars are so bright they light up the night like a beautiful clear afternoon. There's so much grain it will boggle your brain, and it's all ours for the taking. By the time we grow old we'll be swimming in gold if we live out the plans we are making. We have passed the first phase of a marketing slaves, and now we must have all the rest. Let us go see the Pope, strengthen our hope, and make sure that our mission is blessed. We must move right away, without further delay, 'cause this will provide the solution. It's the perfect affair,
to relieve our despair and our commonly shared destitution. It just so happens to be our divine destiny to conquer the heathen nations. We've been granted the right to keep the heathens uptight and to teach them a civilization. We will use every guise, every kind of disguise to assure our benevolent rule. They will have our protection and we'll give them direction by establishing mission schools. We'll give them a god and a chastening rod and establish a measure of trust. We'll plant a seed and create a need, and then they'll be dependent on us. They will learn our speech, and then we can teach them to forget about their past. We'll change their minds until the end of time and make sure that our empires will last. We'll rule the land with an iron hand to assure production increase. And those who rebel, we'll send them to hell in the interest of keeping the peace. Now all that remains is to use our brains to a bigger and inland route. We'll meet in Brussels next year to review and compare and sort the details out.
So they met and discussed without fanfare fuss of the rivers that ran to the sea, like the Gambia, the Niger, the Congo, the Nile, and the mighty Zambezi. Then they finalized plans and they all shook hands and proceeded towards the door. Like a vampire horde, one accord, they embarked.
And if you stay in your places and keep smiles on your faces, you'll receive your reward hereafter. You must cede us these lands upon our demands and do whatever we say. And if you think it's a bluff and you try to act tough, why then we'll just have to blow you away.
But the people resisted when the colonists insisted and the bloodshed started to mount.
So many folks died, the animals cried. Numerous to count.
From the east to the west, they encountered the best of Africa's bitter sons. But one by one, they had to succumb to the fire of the Gatling gun.
But this could not quell the will to rebel, and so the struggle just went underground. And from the north to the south, they were checking out, and they were seriously throwing down. Kadir, there are Mirabal Jeers and Ashaka, the Zulu chief. There was Muhammad Ahmed, who took Gordon's head and the Lincoln Sheikh Samori. There was Umar Mukhtar and Hajj Abdullah and the men of the Western Sudan, who fought them at night and disappeared in the night like a star behind the sand. There was much blood and tears for the next 50 years, and they began to call Africa home. They pillaged till their fingers were sore to the bone. Some got overzealous and others were jealous because of each one wanted more. They were so soon to discover that they hated each other and their problems were worse than before. It was a matter of greed superseding the need to preserve their mutual pact. They forgot they were brothers and they crossed one another and the alliance had started to crack. They had a design to build a railroad line from Cairo to the Cape. They needed to save time and connect all the mines to complete the mineral rate. But they could not proceed because of the need to deal with the humanites. They had landed before on South Africa's shore and were a mean and adventurous lot. They had control of the diamonds, gold, and they had brought that
position was right. They would not yield, and they took to the field, and they gave up a terrible fight. Greed was the cause of the Boer Wars, which further weakened the hand. The unholy alliance had met the defiance of the outlaws who settled the land. I'm back, 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 back. I'm back, 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 back to Africa. Back, back, back to Africa. Back, back, back. I'm back, 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 back. I'm back, 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 back to Africa. Back, 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 back to Africa. Back, back, back. I'm back to back. Colonial Wars and World Wars I and II. An organization called the League of Nations was formed to plan what to do. There had been so much destruction it had halted production and left them licking their wounds. Plus millions of men had met their end and their cities were lying in ruins. It had took a world's war to open the door of freedom to colonized nations. Now was the time to thwart the design of a Western colonization. So one by one they took up guns as an alternate solution. From the Mau Mau in the east, the violence increased to the Algerian Revolution. It reached its peak in Mozambique and spread to Angola and Zaire. It was time to deal with the struggle. Had to be forced, some made the choice to bow out gracefully. Literally all headed back to the wall, and some settlers had started to flee. But some said it's right to stay and to fight, to protect accumulated wealth. We can't give this back to those ignorant blacks, they're not capable of governing themselves. Why then, just make a mess of all that is best, and hamper the natural flow. All we have gained will go down the drain, and the entire free world will blow. So they made some decisions to make some revisions in the original plan, and came up with a scheme to further their dream of continued control of the land. Let's form a pact with those newly freed blacks to keep our influence alive, and they will be still fulfilling our will, and we will continue to thrive. But the people weren't fooled by indirect rule or neo-colonial stealth. They had been schooled and knew how to rule and were determined to govern themselves. Now freedom is gained, and all that remains entrenched on the southern tip is the boa beast with the nuclear teeth and the land in a blonde grip. He thinks he can hold the diamonds and gold, though his back is to the sea. He'll soon realize even beasts can die, and Africa will be free. I'm back, 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 back. I'm back to back, 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 back.
There's a train that comes from Namibia and Malawi. There's a train that comes from Zambia and Zimbabwe. There's a train that comes from Angola and Mozambique. From Lesotho, from Botswana, from Swaziland. From all the hinterlands of southern and central Africa. This train carries young and old African men who are conscripted to come and work on contract in the gold and mineral mines of Johannesburg and its surrounding metropoli. 16 hours or more a day for almost no pay. Deep, deep, deep down in the belly of the earth, when they are digging and drilling for that shiny, mighty, evasive stone, or when they dish that mishmash mush food into their iron plates with the iron shovel, or when they sit in their stinky, funky, filthy, flea-ridden barracks and hostels, they think about the loved ones they may never see again, because they might already have been forcibly removed from where they last left them, or wantonly murdered in the dead of night by roving and marauding gangs of no particular origin. We are told. They think about their lands and their herds that were taken away from them with the gun and the bomb and the tear gas and the Gatling and the cannon. And when they hear that choo-choo train, a chugging and a pumping and a smoking and a pushing and a pumping, a crying and a steaming and a chicken and a wah, wah! They always curse and they curse the coal train. The coal train that brought them to Johannesburg. Thank you. stimela sihamba ngamalahle siveleta la kupayi sangela sawa kuqa hey babe what is this bamalahle stimela Sihamanga malate, sinale tala kupa, ya ya ya. Helele sangina tawa kupa, hey babe, what is it for, pa malate?
Let me go,
Next testimony will be provided by Dr. Helen Mary Caldicott. Dr. Caldicott is an Australian physician, author, and anti-nuclear advocate who has founded several associations dedicated to opposing the use of nuclear power, depleted uranium munitions, nuclear weapons proliferation, war, and military action in general. Caldicott hosted a weekly radio program, If You Love This Planet. In 2009, she was designated a Women's History Month honoree by the National Women's History Project. Dr. Caldicott.
Yes, I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott. I'm a pediatrician. I've been deeply concerned about war of all varieties, killing of all varieties, as I took the Hippocratic Oath and my vocation and life is devoted to saving lives. I followed the Iraq War intensely, the Shock and Awe campaign. In fact, I wrote a book just before George Bush went into Iraq called The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military Industrial Complex, which talked a lot about what would happen in Iraq. Interestingly, though, no one in America really wanted to read it because at that time America was still very nationalistic, patriotic because of 9/11, and they wanted to get revenge. And revenge was going to be on Iraq for no reason, because Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. The children died from a combination of war and the sanctions that were imposed on Iraq, and they starved. And Madeleine Albright, Madeleine not so bright, she was asked if she thought it was worth killing 500,000 children on television, and she said, yes, I think it was worth it. Condoleezza Rice talked about the smoking gun or the smoking mushroom cloud. I mean, they were evil, evil. Evil to kill over 1 million people and create, I think, 3 to 5 million refugees. What they've done is turn Iraq into a slaughterhouse and turn tribe against tribe, replacing the Sunnis who were running the government with Saddam Hussein by the Shias, and the Shias are hated by the Sunnis, so the Sunnis created ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and hence we're in a frightful, dreadful mess, all orchestrated by America. The other thing America did was to use depleted uranium weapons, uranium-238 in Iraq, 360 tons in Basra, and huge amounts in Fallujah, and all over the place. So it conducted a nuclear war, and that area will remain polluted forevermore. So much so that doctors in Basra, my colleagues, pediatricians, noticed a very large incidence of childhood cancer and leukemia. And also the obstetricians observed that there is a very high incidence of very deformed babies, babies being born with no brains, with spina bifida, without arms, with gross congenital deformities, so much so that the obstetricians have told the women in Basra to stop having babies. But this goes on for the rest of time. Uranium is pyrophoric, so when the shell hits the tank, it burns. 80% of it burns, producing tiny aerosolized particles less than 5 microns in diameter that can be inhaled into the terminal air passages of the lung, where it's extremely carcinogenic. It's also in the water supply. It concentrates in the food and the milk. Children are 10 to 20 times more radiosensitive than adults. Little girls twice as sensitive as little boys, and fetuses thousands of times more sensitive. Uranium is excreted through the kidneys. It can cause kidney cancer, bladder cancer, acute renal failure. It goes to the bone, where it causes bone cancer and leukemia, because it's a bone seeker like calcium. So what America has done by using these dreadful, ghastly weapons, they're using them in Libya now and in Yemen and in Syria, is condemning all future generations in Iraq and the other countries where these weapons are used to cancer, leukemia, congenital diseases and genetic diseases, because radiation damages the genes and the eggs and sperm, causing diseases like diabetes and cystic fibrosis and phenylketonuria and all sorts of others. There are 2,600 congenital diseases, and these will all increase in frequency down the time track, and I mean many generations. I wrote an article for the New York Times about this many years ago, about 10 years ago, and they refused to publish it. They said, we are unable to publish this. And it was about the medical effects of uranium weapons. And who told them they shouldn't publish it? And why did they go along with, obviously, the Pentagon? So the whole thing is a catastrophe, a war crime, evil, a nuclear war. And then there was the Coalition of the Willing, which included my country, Australia, and England, and others who supported America in this wickedness, and still do. So that's my summary as a physician, a paediatrician, and I'll leave it at that.
Well, welcome to Sophie & Co. Me, Sophie Shevardnadze. One of the world's biggest nuclear arsenals is now in the hands of Donald Trump, as the new commander-in-chief is handed the codes to America's nukes. With a nuclear threat ever present, how will Washington's policy shape up in this regard? When former United States Secretary of Defense William J. Perry is with me today to discuss all of that.
As the legacy of a bipolar world order wanes, global politics is becoming increasingly uncertain. And with the world's nuclear powers embroiled in the worst standoff in decades, the prospect of nuclear war is suddenly not so outlandish. With one accident potentially leading to the unthinkable, are nuclear arms still the strongest deterrent of war, or are they the biggest menace to the security of the world?
Former United States Secretary of Defense William Perry, welcome to the show. Great to have you with us. Mr. Perry, I remember 10 years ago at the Munich Security Conference, Putin actually warned of growing global instability, wars in the Middle East, NATO expansion, and a nuclear arms race. Now, that was a decade ago. Why have things got only worse during this time?
I think both the United States and Russia have found themselves engaged in a war of words. Rhetoric that's been increasingly belligerent, and also military buildups and threats to military buildups. I think that has put us on a dangerous path, and I'm hoping that President Trump and President Putin will be able to find a way of getting us on a safer path relative to our security of both of our countries.
Well, President Trump has called for the expansion of America's nuclear capabilities on one occasion, and another he's called for reducing nukes very substantially. So which one is it going to be? What's your guess?
I think we won't really know what President Trump is going to do on defense issues, national security issues, until he submits his first defense budget in a few months. There we will see whether he's willing to spend additional funds for defense, which could compete, of course, with other pressures in the economy, in particular, what he will do relative to nuclear weapons. I think on the nuclear weapons, he has said he's going to maintain a strong military. But there it very much depends on what Russia is doing on nuclear weapons. There's a possibility for both Russia and the United States to increase their spending on nuclear weapons, which seems to be the direction we're heading now. That would not only be costly for both countries, but I think dangerous for both countries. But there's a distinct possibility that President Trump and President Putin can decide it's in the interest of both of our nations to decrease the emphasis and decrease the spending on nuclear weapons. That not only would allow both countries to improve their economy, but I think more importantly, it would lower the danger for both countries.
Now, you keep warning people that the chance of a nuclear crisis is greater now than it was when you were Clinton's defense minister. But false alarms happened then as well, right? And it didn't lead to nuclear war. What is different now?
What is different now is that besides the danger of a nuclear war, that is the danger of either the United States or Russia miscalculating or blundering into nuclear war, it's quite clear to me that neither country wants a nuclear war and would deliberately start a nuclear war. The danger now is the same as the danger in the Cold War, that we would blunder into Cold War, as we almost did, for example, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. But beyond those dangers, which are like the dangers in the Cold War, There are new dangers. One of them is the possibility of nuclear terrorism. And, of course, a nuclear bomb set off by a terror group could go off in Moscow or in Washington or in New York or in St. Petersburg. So that danger is new. It didn't exist during the Cold War. And beyond that, there's the danger of a regional nuclear war, for example, between India and Pakistan. So those are new dangers that didn't exist during the Cold War. So the danger of some kind of a nuclear catastrophe, I think, is therefore greater than it was during the Cold War. But we can do many things to reduce those dangers. And what's really important is for the United States and Russia to understand that these nuclear dangers are a danger to both of our countries and find a way of working together to lower the dangers.
According to Associated Press report, the personnel who man America's nukes are poorly trained and have to use retrotech to run the systems, including 8-inch floppy disks. Why neglect maintaining the nuclear deterrent?
I think those accounts are exaggerated, but I am concerned that both in the United States and Russia, that the people who have been manning our nuclear sites for many, many years now don't have the motivation or the perhaps even the skills to do it properly. So that's one of the reasons for finding a way of lowering the dangers. In particular, I put a great emphasis on the danger of our ground-based missiles, our ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, because there the danger is the danger of an accidental war starting. That is, if either the Russian alert system or the American alert system makes a mistake and falsely indicates an attack underway, then there's an impetus on either president to make a rapid decision to launch his ICBMs before the other side's ICBM lands. And of course, if his alert system is wrong, if there's a false alarm, then that president will have accidentally started a nuclear war. Now, this is not an academic possibility. There have been at least 2 false alarms in Russia that I know about, and at least 3 false alarms that I know about in the United States. So that's a very serious consideration. It's not likely to happen. It's a low probability, but it's a low probability of an outcome that would be truly catastrophic.
Now, you've mentioned nuclear terrorism. After last year's terror attacks in Brussels, there were reports that terrorists are trying to infiltrate Belgium's nuclear facilities. And Belgium is also one of Europe's locations for American tactical nukes. With a growing threat in Europe, are American nukes becoming a potential target? Are they sufficiently secured?
I believe the danger of a nuclear terror attack does not come from a terror group getting either American nuclear weapons or Russian nuclear weapons, because the security in both of them is really very good. The danger is that the terror group could get the fissile material, the fuel, the highly enriched uranium. And if they could get that, if they could buy it or steal it, and this is not as well protected as the weapons are, then they could themselves make a crude, improvised nuclear bomb. Crude, but still quite effective. It could be, instead of being delivered in a missile, it could be delivered in a delivery truck. And if they could do that, then there's a danger of that nuclear bomb going off in Moscow or in Washington. So the United States and Russia have this common danger, this common threat, and we should be working together to do everything we can to lower the danger of a terror group getting either a bomb or even the fissile material from which you can make a bomb.
So you don't see a danger in a terrorist group infiltrating a nuclear facility?
I could never say that's impossible, but I'd say that's a much lower danger than the danger of a terror group getting the fissile material. So we should focus on the risks that are the greatest, and that to me is the greatest risk we face today from a terror group.
Now, a Pentagon advisory board proposed building smaller nuclear weapons for limited use. But are they smaller yields and better targeting also maybe making nukes more tempting to use? Even to use first, not just in retaliation.
Yes. I might be very clear. I am totally opposed to any emphasis on so-called tactical nuclear weapons. I think that's very dangerous, either in Russia or in the United States. The thought that because of the yield was lower, that the danger of a nuclear war is lower, is, I think, invalid. Once one side uses a nuclear weapon, even if it's a so-called tactical nuclear weapon, there's no guarantee that we're not escalate into a general nuclear war. So to me, it is a very dangerous assumption to believe that you could use lower yield nuclear weapons without escalating into a general nuclear war. And by the way, the so-called lower yield nuclear weapons are still many kilotons. So we're still talking about an explosion with devastating consequences. So in sum, I am opposed to tactical nuclear weapons And I'm very much very dubious, very doubtful that the use of tactical nuclear weapons would not, in fact, escalate into general nuclear war.
Now, you mentioned India and Pakistan. What would be the consequences of a limited regional nuclear war?
Well, we have to define limited very carefully, because both India and Pakistan have more than 100 nuclear weapons, perhaps 200. And if they used even half of their arsenals against each other, the cities, there would be tens of millions of casualties in India and Pakistan. So it would be a really catastrophic event. Beyond that, the soot and the fumes from the fire in these cities will go into the atmosphere and change the composition of the atmosphere, probably lowering temperatures around the planet a degree or two or three. And that in turn could cause widespread crop failure. And so the effect would not only be profound on India and Pakistan, but actually a limited nuclear war of that magnitude could affect people all over the planet.
Dr. Perry, we're going to take a short break right now. When we're back, we'll continue talking to America's former Defense Secretary William Perry about how U.S.-Russia ties will change under the new administration in Washington and the potential for reducing the world's nuclear stockpiles. Stay tuned. Former U.S. Secretary of Defense discussing the potential for mending America's ties with Russia in the light of the heightened nuclear danger. Welcome back, Dr. Perry. Now, both Democrats and Republicans alike are vehement about keeping up the confrontation with Russia, despite Trump's conciliatory mood. And sometimes this stance goes a bit off key, like when Congresswoman Maxine Waters called Putin for invading Korea. I mean, how knowledgeable are the people who make decisions on these policies? Can they be trusted to steer it the right way?
We have to trust our leaders. They are our leaders, and they're going to be for years to come. And one hopeful note, I believe, is that President Trump has said very explicitly that he wants to have a dialogue with President Putin. And I think that would be very positive. That happens. In my judgment, there are many issues between the United States and Russia which would be very difficult to resolve. But the issues on nuclear weapons, we should be able to discuss and come up with actions that are mutually beneficial. The danger of a nuclear terror group is to both countries. A terror bomb could go off in either Moscow or Washington. The danger of nuclear proliferation is to both countries. So we should be able to find it possible to work together to reduce the dangers to both of us. Even though we cannot work together on issues where we disagree, we ought to be able to work together on issues on which we agree. And President Trump has made it very clear that he would like to do that. And so I think there's a possible opening here after years of no constructive dialogue between the United States and Russia on nuclear issues. And now is the possibility we will have that dialogue. And so I very much look forward to that.
Well, Trump's proposed easing of sanctions for good deals with Putin, like a nuclear arms reduction treaty, will he be strong enough to overcome the opposition from his own administration to making deals with Putin?
I don't have any ability to forecast what negotiating tactics that President Trump might use with President Putin, the extent to which sanctions, for example, would be on the table. I believe, from what I hear and understand, that President Trump would be willing to put everything on the table. And so there is the possibility of a new beginning, a new opening in negotiations, which could be constructive for both countries. Both President Putin and President Trump will be wanting to advance the causes of each of their own nations. But in the case of nuclear dangers, it is a mutual interest between the United States and Russia to lower those dangers. So there is an area, I think, where there's every possibility of being able to lower dangers. I must say, though, that for success in this area, the two leaders have to be able to do what I would call separate the variables. That is, they have to be able to separate out issues in which they cannot agree, which is basic disagreement, from the issues where they do have common interests, can agree, So not let the issues where they disagree get in the way of coming to agreements on the areas where they agree.
What makes you think this piecemeal approach to diplomacy will work?
I'm not sure it will work, but I say it can work. And we can hope that the two leaders will find a way of making it work. Even if we cannot agree on Ukraine, even if we cannot agree on Syria, we ought to be able to agree on nuclear dangers to both of us, to both of our countries. We ought to be able to agree on taking actions and steps that lower those dangers. Those are in the interest of both countries. There's not a conflict there. So we don't have to be able to agree on everything to agree on something, and in particular to agree on something that's very important to both of us.
You know, today thousands of NATO troops are amassed close to Russia's border, in the biggest military buildup since the Cold War, already spurring an arms race. Is anybody realistically planning to go to war with Russia? And if not, because I don't think anyone is, what's the point of this military buildup? What's your take?
I'm very clear that NATO has no plans or intentions of going to war with Russia. That's the last thing anybody in NATO wants. The purpose of the troops there, for better or for worse, the purpose of the troops there is to deter Russia from taking any military action against the Baltic nations, for example. Now, if Russia is not intending to do that, those troops don't need to be there. In fact, as far as NATO is concerned, they'd rather not have to deploy the troops there. So one of the things, besides coming to an agreement on nuclear issues, that possibility that President Putin and President Trump have, it would also be very good to talk about what they can do to lower the tensions in the Baltics, and in particular, have both Russian troops move away from the border and have NATO troops move back. That would be, I think, beneficial for the security of both countries if they could agree to do that.
But Moscow, you know, it's said time and time again that it finds U.S. plans to put a missile defense system in Europe unacceptable for its national security, and that it will deploy more missiles in response, take other retaliatory steps. Why are Western leaders so eager to push this system through, even though they know perfectly well it will only lead to more tension and escalation in Europe?
I must say that I myself believe it was a mistake for the United States to deploy the ballistic missile defense systems in Eastern Europe. I do not believe that the system we have deployed there in any significant way threatens the Russian nuclear deterrence. It is much too small, and the Russian nuclear deterrence forces are much too large. But I can see, and I know from talking with many Russian colleagues, I can see that that deployment is a concern to Russia. That, again, it seems to me, is something that President Putin and President Trump ought to be able to discuss. The idea of the United States backing away from, reducing at least, the emphasis on ballistic missile defense in Europe, or maybe making some sort of assurances about not building up that capability in a way that would threaten Russia. If we could come to some kind of agreement like that, that would also be a benefit to our securities. I do not know whether President Putin and Trump are going to discuss that issue. It seems to me it's an issue open for discussion and one in which there's possibility from making some agreements that could improve the security of both of our countries.
But, you know, the thing is that unfortunately the Russians and the Chinese, they don't bite when Washington says missile defense is not aimed at them. I mean, how can the U.S. convince Russia or China that it doesn't have hostile intent, if that's true?
It's very difficult to convince another side of your intent. On the other hand, it's very straightforward to determine the capabilities. And it is quite clear that the ballistic missile defense system deployed in Europe has virtually no capabilities against the Russian nuclear deterrence. Now, Russian nuclear deterrence is too large, too powerful, too widely dispersed geographically to be significantly affected by it. I do understand the Russians consider it an affront that we would put that kind of a defensive system so close to their borders. But in fact, the technical people in Russia, as well as the technical people in the United States, understand that the Russian nuclear deterrence is far too big and far too capable to be significantly affected by this defensive system.
President Trump took some heat after he called NATO obsolete, but he specified it's because the alliance is not fighting terrorism. While countering Russia in the Baltics is aimed at a hypothetical threat, the growing threat of ISIS and terrorism in Europe and the U.S. are real. In response to Trump's criticism, NATO members are already promising to up their defense spending. Will Trump be able to breathe new life into the alliance, make it focus on a threat other than Russia?
I can't forecast what Trump's actions on NATO will be based on what he has said so far. There's a real possibility, though, of improving the capabilities of NATO relative to real, very real and very significant terrorist threats. And that, to me, seems to be what the direction of the improvements should be.
Now, the U.S. Defense Secretary General Mattis, nicknamed Mad Dog, is a great fan of continued American engagement in the world. On the other hand, Trump really is not. How do you see that contradiction playing out?
Well, in the United States, of course, the president has the final say on national security decisions, but he is profoundly influenced by his Secretary of Defense recommendations. And I know General Mattis very well. He's a intelligent, temperate, thoughtful person. I think, will be a strong and a stabilizing influence in the Defense Department. By the way, the term Mad Dog is something he himself is very unhappy with, and it does not really add in any way accurately describe this person, who's really quite temperate and intelligent. I think that General Mattis, Secretary Mattis, will be a positive and a constructive and a tempering influence on President Trump. He will offer sound advice, which I think will be in the direction of more security and more stability in the world.
I want to talk a bit about Iran's nuclear deal. Now, this deal with Iran was Obama's top success. Trump administration imposed new economic sanctions on Iran, and the president has repeatedly criticized the Iran nuclear deal and wants it renegotiated. Now, it's a multilateral agreement. It took years to negotiate. Do you really think Trump will be able to rewrite it? And what happens if the U.S. drops the deal altogether?
I do not believe that dropping the Iran deal is a good idea. I do not believe we can renegotiate the Iran deal. It's a multilateral negotiation. It took the action of many countries, including the United States and Russia and most of the countries of Europe and China, to get that agreement. So renegotiating it, I think, is quite unrealistic. Dropping the agreement, I think, would be a very big mistake. I would hope that President Trump, would, as he studies that problem, would come to a more temperate view on how to deal with the Iran nuclear agreement. General Mattis has recommended to him that we not drop the nuclear Iran deal, and I hope that recommendation will in fact prevail as we move forward.
Dr. Perry, thank you very much for this lovely interview. We're talking to Dr. William Perry, former U.S. Defense Secretary, discussing America's military posture under President Trump and the dangerous nuclear weapons pose in today's world. That's it for this edition of Sophie and Co. I'll see you next time.
Last night, the AP released a draft memo from the Department of Homeland Security that would have, amongst other things, sent 100,000 members of the National Guard to 11 U.S. states to round up and deport undocumented immigrants. Dated January 25th, the draft memo says participating troops would be authorized to perform the functions of an immigration officer in relation to the investigation, apprehension, and detention of aliens in the United States. Four states that border on Mexico are included in the proposal. That's California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. But it also encompasses Oregon, Nevada, Utah, Colorado, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana. Now, we've had previous cases where the National Guard has been involved in immigration-related issues on border states sometimes. But this would be an expansion to states that typically do not see this sort of behavior, and certainly not on the scale that this would have encompassed. And by the way, in terms of the stakes here, nearly one half of the 11.1 million people residing in the U.S. without authorization live in those 11 states, according to Pew Research Center. Now, this was released late yesterday afternoon. The White House responded. Sean Spicer says the AP report was 100% not true and irresponsible, saying there is no effort at all to utilize the National Guard to round up unauthorized immigrants. So that's sort of accurate. We found out later that law enforcement officials said the memo referenced by the AP was a very early pre-decisional draft that never made it to the head of the Department of Homeland Security. So it's not accurate to say that it's 100% not true. They're reporting on a draft memo. It just apparently did not get very far along the decision chain.
Yeah, no. The memo is 100% real, and they acknowledge that it was real.
Yeah.
To what degree it was set to take effect is a very, very fair point and interesting
question.
It is
a leak and fake news at the same time.
I think, I really wish the media would be more clear about what a draft memo is, though. It's not policy that's going to be imminently be implemented.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than stoking hysteria and framing it in such a way as if, you know, the National Guard is about to deploy and round people up, I just wish that they were a little more circumspect, the AP was, when it was initially reported, because they first put out a tweet this morning that said the Trump administration is considering up to 100,000 troops being deployed across these several states. That's just not really an accurate reflection of what stage in the policy-making process this was at.
So it would be more accurate to say that they were considering at one point something along these lines or some variation on this report.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think Michael's right because then the backlash is, well, you know, they would never do anything like that. While the fact is somebody at a relatively senior position thought it was a good idea to draft this memo, which kind of gives you an insight into the culture and what they're willing to consider there, which is worth noting. But, yeah, they were never going to do it. So the end result is it's worth, for me, worse than if they never leaked the story at all.
Well, so I have
no
opinion on that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think that it's real in that somebody made drafted this memo, and hence it would be considered. It's not real in the sense that Donald Trump already said yes, because he didn't, right? So that's a very, very important distinction. I would certainly report on it, but I would report on it with clarity, as Michael's asking. I certainly wouldn't hold the story. It's a very interesting story. Now, what I'm worried about is that it's going to give them ideas, because I actually think that if they did this, it would have two ramifications. One is that we could begin a civil war. I'm overstating it, obviously. It's hyperbole. But because people would fight back, and they would get very, very animated on this issue, understandably so, as people are being rounded up. On the other hand, I think that it would be very popular with the right, and mm-hmm. I think probably with a lot of independents. And so now I'm worried it's out there, and they're going to go, wait, that might actually poll well, mm-hmm. So maybe we should give it a second thought.
Yeah.
Because I don't think, I mean, among his folks. And
oh, no, they would love this.
Yeah, but I'm not just talking alt-right. I think that a lot of people would be like, hey, there's somebody finally doing something about immigration.
Mm-hmm.
So be careful, you know, how we proceed here, because it could accidentally turn real.
Well, I think that Trump should be careful how he proceeds if he does something like this, because can you imagine how much the conspiracy theory wing on YouTube, the Alex Joneses, are going to fight back when they find out the National Guard is going to be invading U.S. states? They're going to go crazy. Probably not. So it's both true to say that they're obviously they didn't proceed on this as far as we know right now, but we also can't say that they would never do this. We know that another executive order having to do with immigration is coming out within the next week. And also think about how some of these issues have been discussed in the past. Throughout the campaign, Trump said that he wants to deport millions of people, possibly more than 10 million. He's talked previously about setting up a deportation force to go into U.S. states and cities and do those deportations. He talked recently about sending the feds into Chicago to deal with their problems. So the idea that he would send these National Guard troops around the U.S. is hardly without precedent from his own quotes.
And let's remember how this frog boiled in the first place. In the mid-2000s, George W. Bush twice deployed the Guard to the border. And before it was, the National Guard was for natural or man-made disasters, military protection of the population or critical infrastructure. So Bush expanded it to, well, maybe they should go down to the border. And then Obama extended the federal local partnership program that dealt with this issue. Now, to be fair to the Obama administration, they then changed their mind and thought it was leading to racial profiling and walked that back. But two different administrations had begun to get on that road. Now, this draft memo is different. It's not just for the border. It's states that are nowhere near the border, like Oregon. It's much broader. And it has a problem of it authorizes these troops to act like law enforcement and, by the way, to ask for papers. And then that's where the left would fight back a lot because all of a sudden that feels a little like East Germany.
Yeah.
And National Guards are principally state-based entities. So governors are actually the commanders-in-chiefs of the National Guard in their respective states. So in order for them to become a truly federal force, Trump would have to issue some kind of directive to supersede governors in states like Oregon, where you can't really imagine the governor consenting to this kind of deportation force idea.
Yeah, and so I read through the actual draft memo, and in the version that we have, it did require the governors to consent to this. So at least they were considering that. He didn't apparently just think that he could order them all over by himself. But while this is like the headline version of the memo had multiple facets to it, including comprehensive views of all border security over the past few decades, hiring up 5,000 more Border Patrol agents, and also doing a comprehensive review of any actions by states that has the direct or indirect effect of providing funding to the government of Mexico. And so they wanted to do a review of that, which is interesting as well. It also, by the way, included funding for a wall on the border. So this was not just this border, the National Guard. This was a comprehensive set of policies.
And in one of the articles, they said that these National Guard troops would not yet be federalized. It was like, ooh, that doesn't sound good. Now, again, that's not necessarily in the memo, et cetera, but hey, Bush sent them to the border, and here we are now discussing the possibility that they're beyond the border, and I'm just worried that the temperature in this pot is getting a little hot for us frogs.
Trump is making, and has been over the course of the past year, largely unsupported promises to support the integrity of Social Security. Bernie Sanders is out there, even today, actually doing something to try to accomplish that goal. He introduced a bill today designed to make Social Security solvent for a number of additional decades. He put forward this bill that would grant seniors with income less than $16,000 per year an additional $1,300 annually in Social Security benefits, which is not a lot per week or per month, but certainly would help. Now, you might ask, well, how is he going to pay for this additional money that's going out to those who need it most? The new legislation would apply the 6.2% payroll tax to ordinary earnings of $250,000 or more, as well as to unearned income like capital gains and dividends above that threshold. Currently, that is not the way that it works. There is a cap on your contributions to Social Security above which you do not pay any additional money. Very rationally, a lot of people think that, hey, if we want to increase the solvency, that's a pretty easy way to do it. It's, of course, also a complete non-starter on the Republican side. Now let's talk about the stakes briefly. The Social Security system, if left unchanged, would be 100% solvent until 2034. And there's always this number thrown around where after that it could pay out 79% of the current amount it does. I have no idea why that's what they've settled on when you could stop a year earlier and then pay a slightly higher amount. It's weird, but we've just agreed on that as a culture. Sanders' legislation extends full solvency for Social Security through 2078, according to an analysis by the Social Security Administration.
So this is a great example of where the Republicans have no excuse. They're just the party of the rich, and that's it, period. Because the payroll tax is the most regressive tax there is. It applies more to the poor and the middle class, actually mainly the middle class, than it does to the rich. So that is why, since the 1950s, the share of corporate taxes has gone from about 30-35% of all the taxes being paid to about 10% of all the taxes being paid. That's how they rigged the system, so the multinational corporations don't pay the taxes anymore. And the share of the payroll tax has gone in the exact opposite direction. It was a small portion of the taxes being paid overall to the federal government. Now it's a giant chunk. It's about a third of all the taxes that are collected, because it's the tax that goes to the middle class and not the rich. So now here, there's really no reason to say that you oppose this. You say you want to protect Social Security. They say, okay, I got great ideas for protecting Social Security. Let's cut it. Mm-hmm. Or let's make you work longer and retire at a later age, and if you die before you get the benefits, I protected Social Security. Or we could just tax people above $250,000 just the same way we tax everyone else for the payroll tax, and problem solved.
Yeah.
And the Republicans will fight tooth and nail for these tax cuts for the rich, and with no other excuse. There's no excuse about the economy or anything along those lines.
Now, there's historical reasons for all of this, okay? The reason why they present it the way they do, John, is because they always preface it with, if nothing is done. Mm-hmm. If nothing is done, if no action is taken, then it will run out of money in 2034, and then they'll have enough for 78 or 78, and the number varies a little bit mm-hmm. year to year. That's why they frame it that way. The reason why it was capped originally was because there was supposed to be, it was supposed to be an insurance system. There's a correlation between what you pay in and what you get out. That's the reason why it would never went all the way up. But it was designed to, so that 90% of all income is subject to the payroll tax. What they didn't anticipate was the millionaires and billionaires were going to capture yes. so much more of the national income that suddenly we're only taxing 80-something percent. We're losing a whole bunch of revenue. So historically, they're playing by the old rules. They're kind of cheating, playing by the old rules, as opposed to saying, look, there's huge wealth inequality now, so let's lift the cap. That's the real reason to lift the cap. And I just want to add, they also love to say, well, Social Security is just IOUs. I debated a conservative about this, and my answer is, don't you pay your IOUs? What, are you a Welsher? You know, you want to Welsh on grandmothers? Is that where you come from? Is that, of course, that is what they want to do. Mm-hmm.
This is an issue where I think Democrats have a real opportunity to exploit a wedge within the Republican Party, because obviously Paul Ryan's vision of social spending and entitlement spending is slightly different from Trump's. Or at least ostensibly they're different, because Trump ran the entire 2016 campaign, at least rhetorically, insisting that he was going to protect Social Security and he was not going to cut Medicare and so on and so forth, whereas that's diametrically opposite to what Paul Ryan has been promoting for his entire career. He kind of lives to cut programs. That's what gives his life meaning in a way. So I think, you know, Sanders, I think, has taken the right tack here, where he said, hey, if you were sincere in your pledges to protect these programs, I'll work with you in protecting those programs and maybe even yeah. applying additional funding. And that way you'll see maybe force a desirable divide within the Republican Party.
I just want to back up two of the different things that Cenk raised. One is we've covered, I don't know how many times, that change in the share of taxes being paid by corporations versus people of different wealth quintiles and all that. And as Cenk said, it's the corporate share has been steadily going down and down and down over the past few decades. Bear in mind, we've also covered the details of Trump's proposed tax plan from back during the campaign, where he would cut corporate taxes by 2/3. And so expect that if he gets away with that, that share is going to effectively go down to nearly nothing. And he made reference, Cenk made reference to the Republican alternative to Bernie's plan, the ideas that they're okay with. And these are not our, like, straw man version of what they want. A bill introduced by House Ways and Means Social Security Subcommittee Chairman Sam Johnson of Texas would eliminate taxes on Social Security benefits for wealthy retirees, increase the retirement age, and rein in cost of living adjustments, saving $14 trillion and extending the program's solvency by 75 years. So those are two different approaches you can take.
Let me tell you.
You can increase the benefits to those who are worst off. You can do that theoretically, but in so doing, you do have to tax the wealthiest people a little bit, and that's bad, because if you were to tax them a little bit more, they would still only have a better standard of living than any other human in the history of our species. Or you could make people wait a couple more years before they retire and give them less money every single month for the rest of their life.
That means testing idea comes from the Concord Coalition and the Koch brothers, who, when they originally drafted the proposal, they said, what do you think's the level of wealth at which we ought to start cutting the benefits? They said average lifetime income of $20,000 a year. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, they cut it for everybody. So when they say cutting for rich people, they really mean cutting for everybody. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. And number two, don't forget Mick Mulvaney, who is Trump's pick to budget director, or director mm-hmm. of OMB, Office of Management and Budget, who's on record saying we have to end Medicare as we know it, quote from Mick Mulvaney, and on record raising the age, thinking it's a good idea to raise the age for Social Security or cut quote-unquote entitlements in some other way.
Every year of that they raise the retirement age costs you tens of thousands of dollars.
Right.
It is the greatest robbery in American history. Every time they raise the age, that is money you will never get back. Okay? So, and that money goes, they call it saving $14 trillion. Yeah. Who's saving it? The rich are saving it because it's going to them. And so it's an absolute crime. But I want to end on this idea, which is what Michael started with. Bernie Sanders, they said that he was impractical. Right, that was the main charge against him by the Democrats in the primaries. He doesn't know how to get things done politically. Are you kidding me?
Pie in the sky.
Yeah, this is the most savvy, practical political move there is. So where he makes this distinction very clear, if you want to raise the retirement age and you have to work another year or another 2 years and you get less money when you retire from Social Security, then you vote with the Republicans. If you like Social Security, you want to protect it and actually get even a little bit more money, then you vote with Democrats. It is the most popular program in American history. It polls at over 80%, roughly 84% popularity. Now, Bernie Sanders has just clarified that the Republicans are against 84% of American people. That's practical, that's good politics, and that's how you win.
Being raised by some about the price of protecting the first family, let's discuss now CNN political contributor Maria Cardona, Karine Jean-Pierre, the senior advisor at MoveOn.org, and CNN political commentators Paris Denard and Andre Bauer. Welcome back, panel. Maria, you just heard Tom Foreman lay it out. Between the First Lady living in New York to weekends in Mar-a-Lago, the cost of protecting the first family could be epic. But that has always been the responsibility of the Secret Service. So is there anything different now?
Well, there is a couple of things different here, Don. First of all, hypocrisy, which is nothing new when it comes to the Trump administration. He's full of hypocrisy day in and day out. He not only lambasted President Obama every time he would go on a trip saying that it's taxpayer money, how shameful it is, that he doesn't spend enough time at the White House, that he's golfing every weekend. And in 2015, he gave an interview to The Hill where he said if he became president, he would rarely leave Washington, rarely leave the White House. So we now see that that is absolutely not true. The second thing I think that is a big issue, especially for Trump and his family, is the fact that he has four adult children that also need protection whenever they travel. And that's fine. Like you said, that is something that happens. It is what it is. We have to protect the first family, all of it, including the adult children. But when the adult children are out on business trips, making deals, closing deals, and making themselves rich while taxpayers are paying for it, that is a completely different thing.
Let me bring the other panelists in here because we have short time. Andre, the Washington Post reports the Secret Service hotel bill for Eric Trump's trip to South America last month was nearly $100,000. Both the President Trump's grown children heading to a golf course opening in Dubai this weekend. Any concern you think the Trump family's personal business and lifestyle costing taxpayers a lot of dough?
Well, you know I'm a fiscal conservative, and so yes, when I heard just a minute ago in your story that 300 people travel with the president, to me, no matter if it's a Republican or Democrat, that seems excessive to me. And somebody ought to look into ways to save money. I think the first family needs to be protected no matter who it is, and we could argue, look, Bill Clinton bills the United States government to have Secret Service on his property, which to me seems a little bit crazy. It's legal, but he's the only person to ever do it. But you could go through all of them, of the trips they took, and maybe they shouldn't have taken some of these trips. But at the end of the day, we want the most powerful leader in the world protected. But can we do it in a more prudent and responsible way? Hopefully so, and hopefully somebody within this administration will look at it and say, here's where we can save some money. Because at the end of the day, the taxpayers are footing an extremely large bill.
Yeah. Karine, you say this is hypocrisy?
I do. I think it's complete hypocrisy. Like Maria was saying, he chastised President Obama for going on vacation, for golfing, and President Obama had less vacation, fewer vacation days than his predecessor, President George W. Bush. I think for me, the thing that bothers me the most about this is the profiting off of the presidency. Mar-a-Lago, you know, they doubled their initiation fee to $200,000. And also, he actually never let go of ownership of his businesses. So his adult children are traveling, making money for the organization. So he's profiting.
I want to bring in Paris now. Sorry to cut you guys short, but I want to get it all in before we have to go. Paris, what do you think?
Hi, this is fake news. This is not a news story.
Don, tell me what about it is fake, Paris. We're going to go. Are we going down this road again?
Yeah, we are.
Come on, Paris.
I didn't interrupt any of you all. Let me just tell you why. The president is not breaking any laws, and he's not doing anything. It's not his
okay,
fault.
Paris, hold on. Let me ask you this.
No, let me ask you.
I'm going to let you finish. Do you actually know what the definition of fake news is?
What we're doing right now?
No, okay.
Because you are part of the fake news because you are on the network. No.
Let me explain to people out there watching and you what fake news is. Fake news is when you put out a story to intentionally deceive someone and you know that it is wrong. I don't know of anyone who has put out a story in the mainstream media that I can think of right now to intentionally deceive anyone. Now, people get things wrong. Sources sometimes come up empty. But no one that I know has put out anything to intentionally deceive someone. This story that we're doing right now is not to intentionally deceive anyone. We are simply talking about the cost to keep a president safe, the Secret Service cost, and what are the pros and the cons, and as Andre said, and if there are ways that we can maybe able to work on that to make it fiscally better for the American people. There is nothing fake about that. Please stop it with that stupid talking point that it is a fake news story. If you don't want to participate in the news stories on this network, then don't come on and participate. But don't call them fake because you don't agree with them. Go on.
Don? This is a fake news story, in my opinion, because the underlying assumption is that...
Thank you very much, everyone. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for watching. Have a great weekend. Good night, all.
Thanks, Don.
We are not going to let the fake news tell us what to do, how to live, or what to believe. We are free and independent people, and we will make our own choices.
That was Donald Trump last night in Florida. And this morning, we are thankful to be joined by the anchor of Fox News Sunday, Chris Wallace. Chris, good morning.
Hey, Chris.
Good morning, Chris.
Hey, guys. So I'm sure you saw the speech. I know you did. Last night, the president continued his blistering attacks against the mainstream media. But he made some historical references. And I want to play this and get you to react to it. Take a listen.
Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, and Abraham Lincoln, and many of our greatest presidents fought with the media and called them out, oftentimes on their lies.
Chris, we did some research. Thomas Jefferson called the press the only toxin of a nation. Lincoln said newspapers lie and then they re-lie. Are we putting too much into the fact that he's going after the press that's clearly going after him?
Well, I didn't know you were going to say this, but in fact, I have a historical reference here from Thomas Jefferson, who back in 1787,
of course you do.
I really didn't know you were going to say this, said this, and I think we need to keep this in context. He said, "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter." Yes, presidents have always had, and politicians have always had problems with the press. They want good press. The press doesn't always give it to them. But what Jefferson there is, despite all of our disputes, that to the functioning of a free and fair democracy, you must have an independent press. And that is why so many people were really upset when Donald Trump said, look, we're big boys. We criticize presidents. They want to criticize us back. That's fine.
Yeah.
But when he said that the fake news media is not my enemy, it's the enemy of the American people, I believe that crosses an important line.
One of those people that are up in arms about this is Senator John McCain, who's overseas at the moment. And he says that the president's attacks are a sign of a dictatorship. Here's what he said.
If you want to preserve democracy as we know it, you have to have a free and many times adversarial press. And without it, I'm afraid that we would lose so much of our individual liberties over time. That's how dictators get started. The first thing that dictators do is shut down the press. And I'm not saying that that President Trump is trying to be a dictator. I'm just saying we need to learn the lessons of history.
Chris, what do you make of those remarks and also the battle that is brewing between President Trump and John McCain? Because, as you know, these two need each other.
Well, I would say that in terms of what John McCain said there, particularly with the clarification, he's
dictator?
Not saying that
yeah.
Trump is starting to become a dictator, but that trying to shut down an independent and fair media or free media, not necessarily even fair. Part of what the founders said is it can
That's
be
right.
unfair, but the idea is that in the wash of all of the media coming out with all of their reports, it's a check on power, and that it, and he was saying that in state, in dictatorships, there's state-run media, and there's no opportunity for
right.
a free, independent press. So I think he's exactly right there. As far as Trump and McCain, it's absolutely going to be a continuing soap opera saga in this administration. Sharp differences between the two, especially when it comes to foreign policy. Especially when it comes to Russia.
Reince Priebus on your show this morning has said overnight even some critical things about the press and that relationship. What are you going to be talking with him about today?
I'm going to be talking to him about the press and that relationship. No,
right.
I think this is an important time, frankly, for the media to strike back. Look, we are not included in the list of people that the list of deplorables, if you will, that Donald Trump said. But we were singled out by Barack Obama. And I don't think it matters whether it's the president is singling out the organization that you represent or the other organizations. It's wrong. I mean, we can take criticism, but to say that we're the enemy of the American people, I think, crosses an important line. In addition, we're also going to have Rush Limbaugh. Can't wait to get him involved in this conversation.
He'll certainly have comments on that. You talk about the free and independent press, which is totally correct. But what I think what President Trump would say is, I'm taking on the hidden bias. I'm taking on a press that tells you they're unbiased, but actually the New York Times has a massive bias, and then we're supposed to pretend like that's the mainstream media. That's the paper of record. You know, when our founders were there, there were partisan press. Papers were Republican or Democrat or Federalist, and it was open about it. He's saying they tell you they're unbiased, but I know they're biased because I see the fake news. Is there something there? It's not about the independent press. It's about the bias of the press.
I think there's absolutely something there, Pete. And if he had said that, you wouldn't have heard a peep out of me. I mean, Lord knows Barack Obama criticized Fox News. Donald Trump wants to criticize the New York Times. That's fine. But it's different from saying that we are an enemy of the American people. That's a different thing.
Yeah.
And people need, and I know that there are a lot of listeners out there who are going to reflexively take Donald Trump's side on this. It's a different thing when a president, because if it's a president you like who talks about trying to, the press being the enemy of the people, then it's going to be a president you don't like saying the same thing. And
all
that's
right.
very
we'll look,
dangerous.
We look forward to your show, Chris. It's going to be a good one.
Thanks, Chris.
A lot
you
to
bet.
Talk about. Good to see you.
Thanks, Chris.
Personal story segment tonight, legendary anchorman Ted Koppel has interviewed thousands of people, and even though he's out of the day-to-day TV grind, he is closely following what's happening in America. Mr. Koppel, also the author of the book, Lights Out, Cyber Attack, Nation Unprepared, Surviving the Aftermath, New York Times bestseller. Joins us now from Washington. So let's assess Donald Trump. I've interviewed him a number of times. Not an easy interview. How would you do it?
You know something, Bill, you and I have talked about this general subject many times over the years. It's irrelevant how I would do it. And you know who made it irrelevant? You did. You have changed the television landscape over the past 20 years. You took it from being objective and dull to being subjective and entertaining. And in this current climate, it doesn't matter what the interviewer asks him. Mr. Trump is going to say whatever he wants to say, as outrageous as it may be. And the fact of the matter is, his audience, as much as anything, is not even a television audience. It's an audience on Twitter. They deal in messages of 140 characters or less, which keeps it nice and simple.
Okay, but, you know, your old network, ABC, does interview Mr. Trump on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And, you know, it comes in, and you've got to come in with a strategy with him. You've got to come in with sharp questions, and you're right. Maybe his supporters don't care what he says. However, our job, whether I'm a commentator or a reporter, is to get as much information, number one, and two, show the viewer who the person really is. So again, I'll go back to, he's sitting on Nightline, you're opposite him. How do you do it?
Well, the first way you do it is not in the interview. You do it by some reporting. It's an old-fashioned concept, but I think demonstrating who and what Mr. Trump is and what his various policies really amount to is something you don't do in an interview. He doesn't answer the questions. I've seen any number of your colleagues and mine ask him very pointed questions and do it in a perfectly professional and reasonable fashion. He just ignores the questions. When is the last time you have heard Donald Trump spell out a real policy on anything other than we're going to be the biggest, you know, the best, we're going to be the greatest?
Okay, that's it for today. This has been Wake Up Call on Radio Justice. I've been your host, Brennan White. I hope you enjoyed our reach back into the Wake Up Call archives.
It's
and
true
until
that
next
he
time,
is getting
strong,
a pass because he's not a traditional politician, and he's appealing to emotion, which is a brilliant strategy in this age of dissent in America. Bernie Sanders doing the same thing. I mean, let's be honest, Bernie Sanders' programs are just as wild as some of Mr. Trump's programs. But you still
but
have to sit
but
down.
He's coming in a poor second, and Trump is way ahead of the pack. So
right.
It does make a difference.
Right.
Nobody is able to hold Donald Trump to account. Because he's not playing by the traditional rules. So
isn't that a smart thing for him to do, though, if he wants to be president?
It's obviously been an incredibly smart thing. I mean, I don't want to pretend that I've been predicting all along that he's going to win. Quite the contrary. I couldn't imagine that he would win. At this point, I find it hard to believe that he won't. I still think that the Republicans are going to do everything they can to take it away from him at the convention, if need be.
But as I said, if they do that, they lose the election because millions of Trump voters will say, you know what, the fix is in. And Trump himself would run on a third party if that happened, and that would destroy the GOP.
He might, but what they, you know, Bill, I think what they're more worried about right now is
Senate
losing the
House.
Senate and
yeah.
losing the House.
Right. But with all of that defection, all of the Republicans who support Donald Trump not voting for any Republicans, so that, you know, you got to be very, very careful. Now, would you, as a anchorman, you obviously don't approve of Donald Trump. And I tell everybody, look, because he gets angry at me sometimes because I'll have commentators on a program that don't like Trump. And I point out, listen, it's their opinion. All right. And they're entitled to their opinion. And I'm being fair. And I ask their opinion and I challenge. But I have just as many on who like Trump as Andrea Tantaros than don't. But you're in the chair now, not when you were back in Nightline, but now, today, with all the things that you pointed out. It's a whole different ballgame on cable TV. Commentators like me have just ruined the country. I cop to that.
It's true. Yeah.
Right. I've ruined everything. Although the journalists outnumber the commentators by about 50-1, and maybe the journalists aren't as powerful as they should be. But anyway, would you show your disdain at a certain point for a certain candidate? It doesn't have to be Donald Trump. Could be Bernie Sanders. Could be anybody. Would, under these new rules in television, is that allowed?
No, I don't like the new rules of television, and quite frankly, I don't think I would adhere to the new rules of television. It's not a question of what I personally think. It's a question of whether there is any substance there. You asked me what questions I would ask. I think the first thing that has to be demonstrated is a little bit of journalism. Go into some of the details of who and what Mr. Trump actually is, what those policies amount to, and then after you've laid it out, I mean, you remember on Nightline, a 5 or 6 minute piece that lays out the issues. Then you talk to the candidate and you say, why is it that we don't have anything more than just fluff?
Okay, but the problem is that now the network news on the three, CBS, NBC, and ABC, perceived to be liberal. So the people that you might want to persuade are saying, you know what, they don't like him, and they're going to twist their reporting. And it's the same thing with the New York Times and the Washington Post, that a lot of the straight reportage that used to be accepted is now questioned because of this perceived liberal bias, correct?
And the fact of the matter is, Bill, you deserve both credit and you have to accept responsibility. For the past 20 years, as I said at the outset, you have been changing the landscape. The fact of the matter is, it's hard to believe these days, but 30 years ago, a television network anchor, Walter Cronkite, was the most trusted man in America. There's not a man today, yourself included, on television as an anchor who is trusted by anything approaching a majority of the American people.
I did get in the Gallup poll most admired in the top 10, so that wasn't. But well, anyway, look, I'm an honest guy.
That's because you're tall and handsome.
Well, thank you. But you know I'm an honest guy or you wouldn't be sitting there. And whether I've done anything, I always try to be fair and I try to bring the folks a straight story. Ted, thanks very much as always. We appreciate it. Very provocative.
We continue with our rebroadcast. This is Wake Up Call on Radio Justice.